The topic that we're going to try and explore tonight is that of virtual reality and inner peace. In other words, trying to foster some type of pathway which will lead us in the direction of coming in contact with ourselves and with what's inside of ourselves. But let's begin with a parable. Story. Once upon a time, every parable has to have a king, a forest, and a castle. It's basic parables. So there was a king, and the king was seated on his majestic throne in a castle. The castle was fashioned from the finest Italian marble, stretched its turrets way into the sky, until the very top of the turrets were intersected by wispy clouds. And there the king sat on his throne, his majestic robes, his crown upon his head, the finest rubies and emeralds. And next to him sat his daughter, in a smaller throne, the most beautiful of all princesses. And as they sat there, the kingdom was bewildered. The kingdom was confused about the news that they had just heard about the king. The king had just decided that he would marry off his daughter, not to some type of prince, not to some illustrious noble, but to a common villager, a common man, a man that lived on the outskirts of the kingdom in a small stone dwelling. That's who this princess would marry. And the wedding took place in a small hall in the castle. And the villager, he was overwhelmed with his luck. He'd married the princess. And he proudly took her back to his humble dwelling. And he went out with excitement to gather together some fresh straw to lay on the floor that she would have a comfortable bed. The princess, she was used to sleeping on the most comfortable of all beautiful soft mattresses. And here she was stuck on a bed of straw. And it was the best straw and you were so excited. And she lies down on the straw and it's uncomfortable and it's prickly. And then he wants to prepare her a meal. So he goes out into the field, digs up the finest potatoes that he can find, and makes his most favorite of all delicacies, potato peel soup. He can't wait to serve her. But needless to say, she's not that impressed. In fact, she's quite disgusted by the potato peel soup. And it goes on. He keeps on trying so hard to make her happy, and everything he attempts to do is met with disdain and disgust. She's just not buying into any of it. That's the end of the story. That's the parable. The question is, what is the message? That's the mashal, what's the nimshal? What is it meant to teach us? And what it's meant to teach us is critical, I think, to understanding how we function. And that is as follows. This story is cited in the beginning of the famous work, The Path of the Just, by the Ramchal, Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato. And he quotes this mashal and he says that the princess is the spiritual component of man, the princess is the soul, and the villager that she's married to is the body. And as much as the body will try to satisfy the desires of the soul, the body's attempts will be met with disgust, because the soul is much above that. She's a princess, she's a daughter of royalty. You can't satiate her with mundane activity, with physical desires. Now there's something very strange about the mashal, about the parable. It means as follows, that there's a prince, princess, and the villager. Now the princess is the class participation. The princess is Talmudic reasoning with twisting of thumb. The princess is the
soul.
The villager is the body. Now, what does the soul want? The villager, when he goes around searching, if the application is correct, So the pursuit, let's say, of physical pleasure, physical indulgence, is because of the based on this parable, the reason why the body pursues physical pleasure is because of the
soul.
So it's an interesting application. It means as follows, that the spiritual component of man is that which drives him and demands from him to be satiated. And man mistakenly thinks that that satisfaction, that satiation will come through physical means. And therefore he pursues every type of physical pleasure. He searches within the material to satisfy spiritual desire. The desire is not satisfied, so he continues to search, and he tries to offer greater and greater gifts to the spiritual side of his personality, and it keeps on becoming disappointed. So he thinks, well, obviously I'm not giving enough. So he goes searching for more, and it's still disappointed. So he says, well, obviously I'm not giving enough, and the search continues forever and ever. So the first point is that the motivating factor for much of our activity, even in the physical realm, at its source, at its inner source, has got nothing to do with physicality. It's some deeper search for meaning, some deeper search to connect to something deep inside of ourselves, which is misconstrued as a desire, as a pursuit of whatever it may be, whatever form it may take. Understood? That's point number one. In other words, to somehow connect to ourselves, we have to first of all realize where the pull, where the driving force is coming from. And once we can identify the driving force, we can maybe give it what it needs in a much more appropriate fashion, which will help us to become in touch to a much greater degree to who we are, and hopefully bridge the gap, create a congruence and alignment between what we want as people and what we're giving ourselves as people. Okay? Any questions so far? No? Acceptable? Understood? Bennigsen? Shapcats? Happy? Good. Okay, so now next stage. Next stage is as follows. The next stage is, let's attempt to try use some type of method for developing insight into how we can come in tune with ourselves. So now, let's begin in last week's Torah reading, where the Torah reading begins with the following phrase. It says, Vayishma Yitro Kohen Midian. And Jethro heard. What did he hear? He heard that the Jewish people was rescued miraculously from Egypt. He heard everything that God had done for the Jewish people in the Exodus. He heard about the splitting of the Red Sea. He heard about their victory over the evil Amalek. That's what he heard. The implication, the Medrash expounds upon that and says, Vayishma Yitro. And Yitro heard. Says the Medrash. What? Jethro was the only one that heard? And no one else heard? The whole world heard. It says in the verse, Shamu Amim Yugazun. The nations heard and they trembled. What do you mean Vayishma Yitro? Which implies an exclusion. Yitro heard. It doesn't say that the world heard. It says Vayishma Yitro. Yitro heard. It's a question asked by the Medrash. The Medrash answers and says, Ma Shmua Shama Uba. When Yitro heard, now Jethro, he was a priest. He was a Midianite priest. But he was a person that experimented with every type of idol worship that there was in the world. He was the ultimate searcher. He went from pillar to post, searching out any type of weird, far out religion that there was in the world. And then Vayishma Yitro, then he heard. He heard, but he didn't just hear. The verse says, the commentators say, Ma Shmua, what hearing did he hear? Shama Uba, and he came. He was living as a elevated priest in his community. He dropped it all. He gave up his station in life and he moved to the desert to be with the Jewish people and to convert to Judaism. So what was the difference? The whole world heard. But when Yitro heard, when Jethro heard, he didn't just hear. That what he heard made an impact on himself. He didn't just hear information. He heard something, but that what he heard changed him. It motivated, it moved him. There's two different ways of hearing. A person can hear. He can hear he can hear what's being said, and it can go one in one ear and out the other. He can hear, but he can't. In Yiddish there's an expression called hear und der hear. It's to hear on a deeper level, to hear in a way that it just doesn't touch you, but it impacts you on the most profound level. It could be described with another marshal. Unfortunately, no king, no castle, no forest this time. But there is a train, which is a small salvation. There's a train, a villager, there's a villager as well. No king, at least a villager. The villager goes to the big town. He's never been to the big town before. He goes to the big town, the little big town. He sees a big track. He's astonished. What is this track? He's never seen a track in his life before. All he's ever seen is a wagon. He goes onto the track and he's looking up and down the track and he's fascinated. Big iron bars, wooden sleepers, fascinating. All of a sudden, he sees this big vehicle moving towards him. It's the train that's coming. And the train sees him, and he's in the way, he's in the middle of the track. So the train, the conductor starts to whistle. So being a villager, not very bright, he starts to think that this big creature coming towards him is so excited with him on the track, it's teaching him to dance. So he starts to dance to the sound of the whistle. And two people standing on the side of the track look at him and think he's gone crazy. He's heard the whistle, but his reaction to what he's heard is completely inappropriate. He didn't understand the implication of the sounds that he was hearing. We hear the sounds. Everyone heard the sounds. The world heard the sounds. But when Jethro heard the sounds, when Yitro heard the sounds, he understood the implication that they made for him. He understood that if it's possible that there could have been a force which rescued a nation under bondage for so many years, when no slave could escape the evil power of Egypt, and then an entire nation, through miraculous events, came out. He understood that he couldn't hear that. He couldn't understand that. He couldn't listen to that information and remain unchanged. That type of information requires thought, requires action. Okay? So now, there's a point of what's known as this ability to listen, to hear in such a way that changes you is called koach hashmia, the ability to hear. And it has a number of different ramifications. The first of the three ramifications, are as follows. There's a ramification which is external, the world around us. There's a ramification which is internal in terms of ourselves. And there's a ramification which is social, between people. And in all three areas, we have to learn how to hear. We have to learn how to develop ability to be able to hear. Koach hashmia. First of all, listening to ourselves. It's quite funny how often we don't even hear the messages that we broadcast ourselves. The classic joke is a person searching for a parking lot and he's late for a business meeting. He doesn't know what to do. It's a critical meeting. He's frantically driving around the parking lot. Eventually, in desperation, he goes, "God, help me find a parking lot, please, just one vacant space." And soon as the prayer had left his lips, immediately there is a parking lot in front of him. He calls up to God. He says, "Don't worry, God, I found one myself." In other words, the point is that he doesn't hear. He doesn't understand the implications of his own prayer. It's just an example, but it shows that even internally, often we are out of touch with what we ourselves are saying to ourselves. There's so many times a person has a particular vision, a particular ideal, but in the course of life, that ideal becomes camouflaged and missed out on. That's in the realm of internal. In terms of external, life offers such a large variety of messages which are broadcast on a daily basis, which if you're sensitive, if you have an ability to hear, you can pick them up. And if you don't have ability to hear, you miss out on them. For example, a tree. Look at a tree. Now, there are many different types of trees. Which tree looks like a tzaddik, like a righteous person? Any ideas? What's it? An oak tree. Could be an oak tree.
Yeah.
What?
A willow tree.
A willow tree. Possibly a willow tree.
A thorn tree.
Fruit.
It has to be a fruit tree.
Fruit tree.
It feeds people or it gives shade.
Brilliant. Fruit tree. There's a verse which describes which tree. And you all know this verse. Rack your brains. Rack your brains for the Friday night service. No, close. Very close. There you go. Sadik Katoma Yifroch. Sadik Katoma Yifroch. A tzadik, like a palm tree, he will flower. So if you look around the world and you're looking for a tzaddik, you'll find him in the palm tree. Could someone please tell me where you find a tzaddik in a palm tree? Where exactly do you find a tzaddik in a palm tree? Huh? So what is it? Nothing careful. Why is a palm tree? Why? Manish tanaha palm tree mikolah trees. Manish tanaha palm tree mikolah trees. What is different about a palm tree from all other trees? Look at the way almost every other tree. Look at the way the trunk grows. How does a trunk of a normal tree grow? And how does a palm tree grow?
Straight up in the fruit of the tree.
Have you ever seen a branch in a palm tree? There are no branches in a palm tree. It's bizarre. A palm tree grows up like this. A normal tree grows like this. Deviates and the trunk isn't straight. So if you want to see what a tzaddik is, the first thing you see is a tzaddik is straight. You have to conceptualize. The first thing you see from a tzaddik is he's straight. And then you look at a palm tree. The way a palm tree grows, it grows in a series of stages, of levels. It doesn't just shoot up in a smooth way. What happens is it grows a little bit, it sprouts fruits, it sprouts leaves, fruits, and then those leaves die, and then it grows to the next stage, sprouts fruits, tree, and it keeps on going up, keeps on going up. But it goes up slowly but slowly. Slowly, slowly. Goes up and up and up and up. So you see how a tzaddik is and how it grows. A tzaddik has one focus. He knows exactly where he's going. A normal tree has got many different focuses. It dissipates in all different directions. Goes in all. A tzaddik knows exactly where he's going and he goes there step by step by step by step. Never deviating. That's how you grow. You can learn how to grow from a palm tree. You got me, Bennigsen? A palm tree can teach you about growth. That's listening to the world. Now, recently, my wife and I had a discussion. That's the way I'd like to call it, shouting match, but we'll call it a discussion. I was following the wise King Solomon's advice, and she was trying to prevent me. It all occurred, the wise King Solomon says, he commands me to go. He said, lazy man, go look at an ant. So I did just that. The ants happened to be in our kitchen. But nevertheless, I was looking at them. Why should a lazy person go to an ant? Because you learn how not to be lazy. What do ants do? They don't stop. Have you ever looked at ants? Shapcats, I'm sure you've got a few. Exactly. So you look at ants and they're frantically moving. They just don't stop. So if you want to learn, extrapolate. Don't look at little ant-like creatures and say, well, what pests? I mean, so I was busy studying these ants until my wife took out the insecticide and got rid of them. But until then, when they did and squashed, they don't look so well. But nevertheless, until that point in time, you saw what laziness wasn't. You saw what alacrity was. So the world teaches you, a little ant can teach you how to behave. A palm tree can teach you how to behave. A lion can teach you how to behave. How does a lion teach you how to behave? So there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot which says, a person has to be gibor kari, you have to be as strong as a lion to do the will of your Creator. As brave as a lion. And the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, applies it to getting up in the bed, out of bed in the morning. Now, this is very funny. Because we all know, all of us, nature experts, once a lion has eaten its prey, it sleeps for a good 3 days. It's a real yeshiva bocha after the challenge. Just sits there on his back for 3 days. What do you mean a lion? If I want to get out of bed like a lion, I should stay sleeping. So there's a nuance in how you learn from nature. When you're learning from nature, you have to learn the parts of nature which are relevant to growth. You can't just randomly learn from nature. You can't learn cruelty from a lion. You have to learn courage from a lion. You can't learn how to annoy people from a frog. You can learn how to perhaps get your point across. One of the I was just really recently reading about different techniques of teaching, and it's listed as an official technique: nagging. It's an official technique. Yes, you thought it was just something which happens automatically when you get married. It's actually an official technique that you can nag. It gets the point across. Amazing, eh? It's been a secret for all these years. But you meant to... Sorry? Private driver. You have to learn how to listen to the world. You have to learn how to listen to the world. There's a listening to the world. Listening to not only the world, the natural world, the trees and the ants and the lions, but you have to learn to listen to events which occur. Recently, when I was on my way here to England, so I was standing in line at the LL security, and in front of me was a woman who must have been at least 304. She was extremely old. She was old and she was frail, and there wasn't even a millimeter on her face which didn't have a wrinkle on her. And she had thin, thin, wispy hair, and she definitely had half a hunchback. And she was being wheeled in this wheelchair, this big wheelchair, and she gets to the security checkout point, and I thought, there's no way they're going to force her to go through. I mean, she can barely walk. She's in a wheelchair. So I thought they'd just like push her around. Oh no, not LL security. No, give her it. Up you go. And they made her stand up. And not only did they make her stand up, but they made her take off her jacket, because obviously they were scared that she really looked like one of the Al-Qaeda agents. And therefore they made her take off her jacket and put it into the x-ray machine, and bow-leggedly she stumbled through the metal detector. She came out okay. Moment of nervousness there, but she came out okay. She didn't have like a big Magnum 38 in her pocket, surprisingly enough. So that's an experience. So now you can look at that experience, and you can take that experience at face value and say, okay, what happened? Oh, I'll tell you what happened. I was in security, an amusing story, and this woman got. She was forced, even though she was ancient, but nevertheless she's still questioned. Or else you can listen to the message. You can use the message as a impetus for growth. How do you hear the message from that? So you see, it's quite simple. That when you have a potential threat, which is exactly why the security checks are administered, so when there's a potential threat, you have to make very sure that there's even a potential danger, and even if it's in a very unsuspecting place, but you never know. If the danger is great, you do not take a chance. And even though it's perhaps in the most of all most unsuspected places, check it out. So then I can understand that that's relevant for myself as well. Perhaps I'm prone, perhaps it's inside of me, and also there's something which can be dangerous. Maybe it's the fact that I get angry. So I have to be very careful. If I know that there's potential threat inside of self, so then you have to be very careful where I tread. And if I put myself into a situation where I know that there could be a potential threat, let me be very cautious how I tread. And then that mundane experience of a woman held up at security becomes an impetus for growth, an impetus of moving yourself forward. Because you don't just see the world. The world doesn't just go in one ear and out the other. The world acts as a place for understanding. It acts as a place for learning. It acts as a place for opening up a completely new dimension to the face value of experience. So far, so good? Any questions so far? We can continue? Okay. Then there's, that's the internal, the external, the world around you, and then there's the ability of socially, learning to listen socially. This is one of the hardest things. It's one of the hardest things. Not listening socially wrecks relationships more effectively than most other things. Classic example. Man arrives home, has jacket upon back, comes into the lounge, takes off his jacket and throws it on the couch. He's going out in 10 minutes' time. Wife says to husband, honey, do you want to just put your, hang your jacket up, just pop your jacket on the wall? He goes, no, I'm going out in like 15 minutes, it's fine. She goes, can you just like pop it on the coat rail? So no, he says, it's okay, I'm just popping out in a few minutes now. Don't worry, it's not going to be long. She says, do you want to just hang your jacket up? He says, I'm going in 15 minutes time. It's not going to do anything in the interim. Why would I bother hanging it up? She says, please hang your jacket up now. He says, no. She says, you hate me. Normal interaction. What happened there, clearly, is that what he heard was as follows. The reason why you hang your jacket up is because when the house is a mess and you can't see what you need to have, so it's inconvenient, it wastes time. So therefore there's a need to have order practically, so you have to hang your jacket up. But what perhaps his wife was interested in is the house doesn't feel right if it's messy. It's uncomfortable to have messiness in the house. But when he was listening, he heard she wants practical order. So practically it makes more sense, since he's going out in 50 minutes, to leave the jacket on the couch. And what he didn't hear was there's something else underneath the request which has nothing to do with practicality. It's got to do with a sense of aesthetic beauty. And therefore, since there's a lack of communication, so nothing starts. It even goes deeper. That because we are stuck, generally we are captured within our own conceptual cages. Which means as follows. The paradigms that we have, we're very comfortable to work within paradigms, and we're very reluctant to break out of paradigms to see things in new and fresh ways. Because that's a natural thing. The default status of the average human being is you generally interpret everything you see in terms of the knowledge that you previously have had. And you create systems and you fit everything into that system. So if the person who's communicating to you is working with a different system, you'll never understand what they have to convey to you. Because your systems are different. So one of the most basic skills of communication is you have to learn how to hear the other person, not in terms of your system, but in terms of the system that they're working with. And if you can't do that, you'll never be able to communicate. You'll never get what they're getting at. How'd you do that? So I remember an experience that I had when I was learning in Shiva with a learning partner, study partner, and we were discussing the notion of a loan. And in Gemara, one of the most fundamental things you have to do is you have to have that skill. If you don't have that skill, you can't really begin to learn well. And you have to be able to question, you have to almost let go of any preconceived notions. You have to open your mind completely. So, and he caught me completely off guard. He said to me, why do you have to pay a loan back? I said, well, because someone gave you the money, you have to give it back. But he said to me, halakhically the money is yours, meaning you don't have to return the same £10 bill, you can give back another £10 bill. So it means that the money that's been given to you belongs to you. So where's the obligation to return it? Where does that come from? So I said to him, oh, 1 second. And then we went into the discussion and it became clear to me that I had no understanding, really. I never examined even a simple notion as why do you have to pay money back that's been given to you. I never approached it with an open mind. So there's an ability when you're dealing with people, when you're communicating, you can't assume. You can't assume. What we do is, almost by default, we assume what's about to be said. You anticipate the person saying what he's saying, and therefore you understand it. You hear what you want to hear, and you see what you know. But in terms of grasping the depth of the person, coming to terms with what they're trying to convey, we're very weak at that. So therefore, in terms of developing the koach hashmia, the ability to hear, which then puts you in touch with yourself internally, with the world around you externally, and with other people, the first thing you have to do is you have to ask the questions. You have to open up your mind and learn to see things differently. A fascinating experience of learning to see. There's a book I've just been reading. It's called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. It's a brilliant book. If anyone wants to learn how to draw, I strongly recommend it. It's written by a person called Betty Edwards. And it's basically a book which, in her book, she has this hypothesis that the problem most people have with being able to draw, they do not lack the hand-eye coordination or the fine motor skills to be able to make the shapes on the page, because people can write. It's not a lack of dexterity with their fingers. The problem why people can't draw is because they can't see. They cannot see. They don't know how to look. And she divides it up between the left and the right brain, and she says, because people see symbolically. So since I know I have in my mind what a face looks like, because when I got to the age of drawing, generally progresses until the age of 8 or 9, 10, depending on the person, and people who don't have a particular inclination towards art, so generally their ability to represent realistically figures stops at the age of 10, and they can be 40 and they'll start drawing, and they'll be drawing the drawings of a 10-year-old. And that's because at that age, you basically come up with symbolic images, a symbolic face, a symbolic house, a symbolic tree, and you never draw things. Whenever you see the thing, if I ask you to draw a face, you won't draw the face. You won't draw the shapes of the face. You'll go in your mind, you'll override what you're seeing with a symbolic image that you'll draw on the page. Do you understand? It's fascinating. You should try it. So one of the first exercises that she advocates is take a picture, and she's actually got a picture of Einstein, which is a beautiful picture to draw because he's got all these furrowed brows, so many graphic wrinkles. It's gewaldic. And take the picture, she's got actually printed in the book, an upside down picture of Einstein. And it's funny because when you see things upside down, you can't recognize them. So you don't see a face, you see just a collection of shapes. So I took the picture of Einstein, I took a piece of paper to make it even less recognizable, and I covered over most of his face, and then I just started to, as accurately as I could, draw the lines, just the furrows in his brow, and then I kept on moving the piece of paper, and I drew the lines, and I drew the lines, until eventually I got to his eyebrows, and I didn't know there were eyebrows, I just drew shapes, and when I finished the picture, I completed it, I turned it around, and there was an exact image of Einstein. It was shocking. And at the time when I was drawing it, I was not drawing Einstein, I was following shapes. So then I saw that I have a bit of background in art, but I saw that I started drawing, and all my drawings I started doing afterwards, I turned them upside down, and the accuracy was increased 100-fold. Because even in the subtle ways where I'm used to drawing, I would always draw what I thought and not draw what I saw. So you see that even on a basic perceptual level, we don't even see what's in front of our eyes. We even override the visual input. And a person's not able to see a fine contour, it just all completely bypasses us. Which is fascinating, because it means we almost have to relearn how to see. And it's all part of this same ability that we have to see things afresh. We have to see things anew. What happens is we capture ourselves in old systems of thought and we never really break out of them. So all new information, all radically innovative, revolutionary stuff completely bypasses us. Because we can't re-examine. We can't change. We can't. Yisro, he had a system established. Everything was put into place. He didn't have to go looking for new religions, but he's willing to examine things from the start. So he looked at it, and then he completely re-changed his whole paradigm, and he came out with a whole new. He got up and left, and went to the desert. So I think the first thing of trying to achieve this elusive state of inner peace is we have to be able to. There's a very interesting, it's a bit shocking, and I hope I'm allowed to speak again after I say these words. But it's quite radical what I'm about to say. I don't want to offend anyone. all offences, complaints can be sent not to the JLE but to my own personal address. There's one of the great ethicists, the Baalei Mussar, the Alter of Kel. He advocates the following procedure to avoid this problem. So a person should do once a month, once every 2 months, is you should do a bit of a stock taking of your life. And it's interesting the way he says you should do it. Go through your life and assume that everything you're doing, and this is brutal, that's why it's an uncomfortable, it's a very uncomfortable thing to do. I don't know if we have the capacity, I don't even know if we have the capacity to do it. I tried it a little bit, and once I picked the broken pieces of self off the floor, I didn't try it for a long time afterwards. But this is what he advocates. They were men of metal. He says, a person should, every month or every second month, go through his life and absolutely and categorically dismiss and degrade everything he's doing. Not only the bad, the good. Try find the bad in what he's doing. Try, in other words, totally and utterly annihilate his entire approach to life. That's quite harsh. That's quite intense. But the reason why he says that you should do it this way, the reason why he takes such an extreme view, is he says as follows. He says, our natural inclination is to justify everything we do. And we need to have almost like power. I'll give you an example. An example, of course, is illustrated by Moshe. And luckily, in this parable, there is a king, there is a forest, and there is a throne. But since we've already illustrated the throne and the king, we'll just get to the point where the king turns to his faithful servant Igor and he says, Igor, let us go for a walk in the forest. So Igor and the king go for a stroll in the forest. And they begin to walk between the trees. And then a sight attracts the king's attention. My gosh, as he looks to his left, he sees a tree. And on the tree is drawn a target. And in the target, in the bull's eye of the target, there's an arrow. And he's astounded by the marksmanship of the archer. Impressive in the bull's eye. Keeps on walking, keeps on walking, keeps on walking. Another tree. Another target. Another arrow in the bull's eye. This is getting even more impressive. Keeps on wading their way through the forest. And they come to another tree, and another target, and another bullseye with an arrow in the middle. And as they are perplexed in wonder over the skill of the archer to three times in a row get the arrow in the center of the target, they see a man dressed in green come out from the behind a tree, and in his right hand he carries a long bow and a sheath of arrows upon his back. He's walking around in a clearing. He sees the king, sire, at your service, says he. The king says, Master Archer, is it you that shot these arrows? The archer says, indeed, it is I. Tell me, Master Archer, how is it that you manage to get them in the bull's eye every time? Says the archer, it's quite simple. First I shoot the arrow, then I draw the target. In other words, that's what we do. The Alter of Kelm, in his Dismantling Your Life, he says, our natural way of working is we decide what we want to do, and then we build a theory about how that's the right thing to do. First we shoot the arrow, that's exactly what I want to do. Now we draw the target. Oh, look at that! In the middle! My life and what I want to do is exactly, it's the right thing, it fits together. It's astonishing, what a coincidence. So says the Alter of Kelm, look at yourself, examine things. But let me tell you something, unless you use radical shock treatment, you're going to come up with the same conclusions every time. What I'm doing is right. So you have to take the opposite extreme. Assume what you're doing is absolutely wrong, and then you'll be able to accurately evaluate if it's right or not. If you don't make an assumption, if you just look at yourself and say, okay, let's see if it's right or not, it will always be right. So therefore, in order to straighten out a crooked brain, you have to bend it to the other side and assume everything you're doing is wrong. Which is why this is the last time I'm going to be speaking as a rabbi. I've decided to pursue my career in drawing and become an artist. Go live in Corsica. It's not a bad idea. So that's a way of gaining insight. That's a way of gaining an appreciation of where we are. That's a way of getting in touch with our real values. That even fits in with the title. How's that? A title and a share, which is actually related to the title, even though the title, the search for tenets upon which we base our lives. Perfect. To understand, it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very gruesome thing to do. But on the other hand, the rewards can be so liberating. You can actually start to touch on parts of yourself which have been covered up, which are dead, which are real parts of yourself. Which are real parts of yourself. Let's go further. Let's go slightly further. In Judaism, there are two categories of evil which are presented, and they're very different powers, forces of evil. The one is known as, in Hebrew, Nega, and the other one is known as Pega. Two independent forces of evil which are there, which seek to go against a person, to deprive a person of actualizing themselves in the true sense of the word. And how do they work? Well, the koyach, the strength, the power of nega is when it's like a cancerous growth. It's very active. It grows the whole time, but in its growth, it's destructive. It's one type of evil force that exists within a person. Another type of evil force is it doesn't grow at all. It pushes a person down. In other words, a pega is a collision. It's as if there's a force which pushes down. So there's two types of evil which exist within a person. The one is it causes a person to come out of himself, to realize his strength. But it takes all his potential and all his greatness and misdirects it. And creates a shoot an arrow, draw the target, a life which allows a person's got an incredible intellect and insight of people. So he uses it to become a con man. And he's able to deceive people left, right and center. He's very active. He's very busy. He's bringing himself out. He's actualizing himself. But the potential for goodness which lies within him is misdirected. That's one power of evil which exists within a person. A second power of evil which exists within a person is called pega. That means the person doesn't do anything. The person remains passive. It pushes him down. It doesn't allow him to express himself at all. Interestingly enough, the Maseilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just, says as follows. Do not think, this is what he says, do not think that inactivity is a product of fear. Rather, fear is a product of inactivity. Or, because a person has a power inside of himself which stops him from realizing himself, he creates fears which then prevent him from doing what he needs to do. The example the Path of the Just brings is, person needs, he wants to go learn Torah. He says, I can't go learn Torah. He says, but your Rebbe's coming to town. He's in the province. He says, maybe there'll be a lion upon the way. So then they say to him, you know, your Rebbe, he's in the neighborhood. He says, I don't know, maybe there'll be a lion between the roads. He says, he's in your house. He says, I'm sure the door will be locked. They say, it's open. He says, I'd rather just sleep. So that's the process, that we have a mechanism which manufactures fears and anxieties which then prevent us from realizing ourselves. That's part of the evil which is known as pega. It oppresses a person. It makes a person lazy. It doesn't allow a person to realize and actualize who they are, because it creates a whole system of fear upon fear upon fear. You can't do that. If you do that, this will happen. Don't even try that, because then you'll be... Don't go for the job interview, because they may say no, so don't even go. And those type of things inhibit a person and stop him. So there's two parts of evil which cause a person not to realize himself. The first thing is that the power of nega, which says you can achieve everything, but it misdirects it in a completely wrong direction. And then there's a kirch of pega, which says don't even try anything, it's not worth it, don't take a chance, there should be no risks. I was recently speaking to a businessman, and I was discussing to him the problems of business. It seems to be almost discussing people who are in real jobs, as opposed to myself, that I just schmooze with people all day long. One of the things which seems to be almost a common characteristic which people suffer in work is the monotony. So I spoke to this particularly successful businessman, and I said to him, what do you do about it? So he said, here's a principle. And he says, the principle he heard from someone very close to him, and he says it's made this person extremely successful. He says, a person should strive to make himself redundant. Should strive to make yourself redundant. In other words, make sure that you get other people to do the job you're doing, and once you've trained and you've facilitated that, your job no longer needs to be done by you, so then that frees you up to move to the next level. So I told this to people who are in the serious work world, and universally was met with the same reaction. If I do that, I'll lose my job. So I went back to him and I said, I told people, and they said, if they do that, they'll lose their job. So he said, fear. He says, the job market is so open today. Employers are looking for people who have initiative. The guy that makes himself redundant is the guy that's going to be hired. And people won't do it because they're scared that they're clinging on to the job security. So what happens? So they inhibit themselves. Because you can't rise out from where you are, because who knows, there's uncertainty. So that's an example of pega. You can't achieve this because... But I don't know if fear. It's not that the fear produces inactivity, but the lack of the pega causes the fear to come about. The fear is not real. Of course, then again, I'm not working. But the fear is not real. That's what he said. Interesting. So then we go on. There's another means. There's another gauge or barometer for evaluating ourselves.
Sorry, just to ask, is
nega worse than hega? Both are as bad as the other. They're just two different things which affect people differently. You know, in other words, and you can have both in different areas of your life. Sometimes you're ferociously active in a particular area of your life and it's completely not productive. And sometimes at the same time, in another area of your life, you're very inactive. So it's not even that one person only suffers from one of the two ailments. You can suffer from both simultaneously in many different areas. So this isn't very inspirational, is it, Sean? It's okay, it's quite depressing. Doesn't matter. Okay, so that's... Now, there's another step. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says the following thing: Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam emet. On three things the world stands. The world doesn't mean the world. The world means you. In other words, there are three fundamental principles which justify life. Three fundamental principles. They are Torah, the learning, the occupation of Torah, of the study of the Torah, avoda, which is service of God, or as it's interpreted today, prayer, and gemilus chasodim, kindness, being kind to other people. Those are the three things which are critical. Those are the basic building blocks of a man. That's what man is made up of. Those are critical. Those are critical. If you don't have those, so then you don't have a world. You don't have a world. And one of the commentators illustrates it in the following way. He says there are three cardinal sins. Three cardinal
avera that if you do them, if you put into a situation when someone would take a gun to his head and say, do this transgression or else you will be killed, a person, according to Jewish law, is obligated to give up his life. And those three cardinal sins are... Murder.
Adultery.
Idolatry. Three big ones. Murder, idolatry, and adultery. Those are the three big ones. Someone comes up, puts a gun by your head and says, kill this person or I kill you. You have to give up your life. Commit this illicit relationship or else give up your life. You have to give up your life. Worship, bow down to this idol, kiss this idol. You have to give up your life. Those three cardinal transgressions parallel the three things that your world is based on. Do you see them? Let's see which ones parallel which. Bennigsen, looks like you've got a head start there. Which one parallels which? Murder is parallel to, is the antithesis of... Murder is the opposite of kindness. Why? Because murder means that a person is irrelevant. Person, a man, plays no part in your life. You can shoot him. Gimilut chasadim means a person is of the most elevated status. You're so concerned about his well-being that you'll bend over backwards to make sure he's got everything catered for. So the antithesis of that, in other words, it's one long spectrum. On the one side is gimilut chasadim, on the other side is murder. And therefore, the furthest you can get away from murder is gimilut chasadim. In other words, the furthest you can get away from the antithesis of life is chesed. That's amazing. Next one, Shappy. One is idolatry and one is avoda and avoda zora. One is false worship. You acknowledge that there's a power that's in the heavens which is not the ultimate power, which is not God, and you give that credit. The antithesis of that is serving God. And the further away you move from that, the further you move towards God, and the closer you move toward it, the further we move. So it's again, it's a spectrum, it's a long continuum. The last one is a bit tricky. I mean, by process of elimination, it's not that hard to work out. But for some reason, Torah corresponds to adultery. Why is that? It's simple. Because adultery means as follows. A person who's willing to compromise on the loyalty in a relationship, Rahman and Islam, he's willing to disregard the bond between husband and wife, for example, and all he cares about is the fulfillment of base animalistic desires, so he's an animal. He's an absolute animal. The exact opposite of a person that's governed by his bodily drives is a person that lives in the world of Torah. A person that lives in the world of Torah, he's elevated himself to a degree where the animalistic soul is under the control of his being, of his seichel, of his intellect. The intellect rules him. He does things which are right, not things which he compromises. His body and his soul... He rides upon, it would be expressed by the sages, he rides upon the donkey. The donkey is always representative of the material. As it says that there was this eternal donkey. When Moshe Rabbeinu returns, Moses returns to Egypt, it says, and he put himself upon the donkey. And Rashi comments, this is a donkey that Abraham took Isaac to be bound, and this is a donkey that the Messiah will ride upon. What is this? The oldest donkey in the world. Thank you, Rashi. The great and old donkey, Gavaldik. So the commentators explain, obviously we don't care about the age of donkeys, and we're not worried about where this donkey's been in stable for so long so that he's ready for Mashiach. What it means as follows, that there are three great figures in Jewish history. There was Abraham. Abraham was great, so the world was created in his merit. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, he spoke face to face. He received prophecy. And the Mashiach, he'll come and he'll save the world. Great, great, huge neshamas. These neshamas, these souls will be so great that they'll be completely in control of the physical. That's what the metaphor of riding upon the donkey is. A person that's saturated in Torah knowledge, he rides upon his donkey. So in that scenario, it's the complete opposite of adultery. It's going in the complete opposite direction, the antithesis of one another. So These three things are the pillars of our life. Those are the foundations. When you build your life, that's what you build your life on. And when you go about, as I'm sure we're all going to do immediately that this year is concluded, we're going to go back and dismantle our lives completely and look at them in a new and fresh light. So what we have to examine is, what are the tenets that our life is based on? Is our life based on, if my life is a scary thing for me to think, is my life based on Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasidim, or is it not? If it's not based on those things, if the tenets which are basing my, which my life is running according, is the foundation of my life, is not but that, so then I have to go a serious soul searching to do. Then there's something fundamentally wrong. And I have to kind of reconnect to that. Because ultimately, those three principles are what inspire and connect to the reality of my soul. And until I've created an alignment and a congruence between those three principles, those three tenets, and the actions that then are carrying out those three tenets, until I've done that, so then I've not quite managed to lock into who I am as a person. And I suppose that's our job. Practical advice. Which perhaps could be useful, is first of all, it's brave, but to try to do what the Altar of Kelm suggested. Try going, instead of complementing our life, dismantling our lives, try to, once a week, pick an event in your life and derive a conceptual lesson from it. Like the woman walking through the metal conductor, or the palm tree, or the ants. An event that occurs to you could be something happens on the tube or the tube itself. Try write up some type of conceptual meaning about what it could mean. And another helpful thing is writing. Some people are predisposed towards this and others not. But to write a journal and you see development. You see progression. And then you're able to get a much clearer hold on where you are and what you're doing. Ideas for exploration. Thank you and good night.